Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Nick Bogert. Nick has a fascinating background in media as a reporter, as a producer, as a field person, on-camera person, covering some of the most interesting stories that have passed in the past decades. But now he is in Three Oaks, in the our region, and is a board member for the Museum for the Region of Three Oaks. Now, the title is changed, but that's what we're going to work with right now. Nick Bogert, With Respect. Nick, how are you doing today?
I'm well, John. How are you?
Good. I'm wonderful. Oh, I love that voice. I can tell. I can hear you giving Brian Ross giving a story. And
oh my! Well, Brian Ross is pretty rarefied air. I'm used to a microphone.
Brian Ross actually did a show with me.
Oh, did he?
An interview with me, and it was one of the beastly lessons I learned in venturing into the world of national media people. And we had just sentenced the executives of a company making orange juice and diluting it. And so it was sort of antibiotics were put into it and whatnot. At any rate, ABC decided, when he was with ABC, decided this is a great story, you know, about poisoning. You know, it wasn't poisoning, but messing
tainting
with the
anyway.
Orange juice.
Right.
And so Brian Ross came out and he did this show. And we did it in a courtroom. And he had all the writing just perfect. He had his, you know, his three cameramen and doing cut shots and everything. And he wanted me, even though I was U.S. attorney, to say things which a U.S. attorney shouldn't say about how terrible these people were. What do you really think about this, Smetanka?
He wanted the catchiest soundbite he could get.
He wanted to get a cue. Mm-hmm. So he asked the question. He said, all right, Prosecutor Smetanka, what do you really think about this outfit, this program, this, you know? And I said, well, this is obviously a criminal law violation. I gave him the pat answer. And he said, okay, but now, Prosecutor Smetanka, what do you really think about this? And he tried this for different phrases for the longest time.
I'm sure you were disciplined.
I was disciplined. Until finally, what he pulled on me was, he said, all right, well, that's good enough. Turn the lights off, we're done. And then he said, after the one set of lights goes out, he said, well, John, what do you really think about this? And like
did
a fool.
Oh, my.
And that was the quote that went on national television.
Wow, yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I'll tell you, the prosecutor I interviewed over and over who would never give you anything beyond what they call the four corners of the indictment was Janet Reno.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, she was very disciplined about that.
I worked with Janet Reno for a year when I was U.S. attorney and she was attorney general. We had a very good relationship because we got involved in certain cases that were important to her and to the department. And I got to really enjoy working with her. She was a fascinating individual.
I think so. I think she probably was much more fun when you didn't have a camera with you than she was when she, I mean, she was very straight-laced, very disciplined about not saying more than she was, the minimum amount that she could say.
That's interesting because when I would talk to her about various issues, I remember that I did a lot of the talking and she did a lot of the listening. And I remember at one point we had a long couple of hour conversation about a number of different issues that were current for the department. It's my last time talking to her and for any length. And I remember going through all of these points about dangers that are out there. And at the end, she didn't say a word. And at the end, she said, now, John, I want to tell you, I agree with everything you said, except for one thing. And then she said something about this issue. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, Janet, you, Turkey, you kept quiet for 2 hours.
Well, I think that's somewhat emblematic of her character, which is not good when you're interviewing her.
No, no.
You want her to do more of the talking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Nick, where are you from originally?
Chicago, Illinois.
And where were you, what side of the city were you?
North side.
Uh-oh.
North side.
Uh-oh.
Well, I've lived on the south side, too, so don't...
All right. Are you a Cubs fan or a Sox fan?
I root for them both. Sorry. That's a wishy-washy answer, but
it is a wishy-washy answer, and that doesn't satisfy anybody.
My first team was the 1959 White Sox, who went to the American League pennant.
Right.
And I grew interested in baseball then, but I was on the north side, so I could take a 22 bus to Wrigley Field. So it was hard, even though the Cubs were terrible, it was hard not to enjoy the baseball.
Oh, yeah, sure. So where'd you go to school?
Well, Francis Parker School in Chicago, and then Middlebury College
in Vermont. Interests? Yeah. What were your interests when you were growing up?
I was always a kid who read the paper. And the interest started out with baseball, actually. The 1959 White Sox could get credit for my literacy, I guess, to some degree. And I could figure out batting averages when I figured out how to divide, you know, smaller numbers into bigger ones. And I was also very interested in politics. I always thought that was interesting, Chicago being a fairly interesting city to observe politics.
That's putting it mildly.
My parents were somewhat active in, I would say, democratic reform politics. My father had the interesting experience of being the head of Citizens for Daley in 1967 and then one of the heads of the McCarthy campaign in 1968. So his opinion of Mayor Daley changed rather rapidly.
I'm familiar with that, with both the Daleys and that McCarthy campaign from personal experience. Mm-hmm. So tell me about your parents. Are you an only child, a brother, sisters?
Got two sisters. One of whom lives in Connecticut and teaches kids how to read.
Mm-hmm.
The other of whom is the head of something called the Marshall Project, which is a public service journalism project dedicated to the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. named after Thurgood Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do a lot of good work. That the editorial head of it has been Bill Keller, the former New York Times editor. He's actually retiring now, and she's searching for another editorial person. My father was a lawyer. At a large downtown law firm, wrote wills and trusts and that sort of thing.
He's not the one who wrote Bogert on trust.
That's his father, who lived in Three Oaks, Michigan for a long time in the summers. He had a summer place here.
Yeah.
Kaiser,
he is famous.
Kaiser and Minnick.
When I went to law school, I remember, was it Bogert on trusts, as I recall?
Formal title was Trusts and Trustees, but everybody referred to as Bogert on trusts.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people have... I can't say all of them are fond memories of that book, but I talk to a lot of lawyers who are familiar with the name anyway.
Well, I tell people who ask me whether they're going into a career in law and they want to know, is it worthwhile, or they have finished and they're interviewing for a job, on both sides of that law school divide, I tell them, law school is an interesting place. It's not necessarily a place to have fun. In fact, and I don't tell these people until afterwards, if someone tells me in an interview that they loved law school, immediately I thought...
Evidence of a personality defect
in
your mind?
That's right, exactly.
Well,
maybe they ought to be law school professors, but they certainly don't belong in practicing. I'm joking, but it's not a pleasant time, but it's worthwhile.
Well, my father always said that the single best year of his education was the first year of law school, and he thought that people who went into almost any sort of profession could benefit by going to 1 year of law school. He wasn't necessarily advocating everybody become a lawyer.
Yeah. One of the things my dad told me was that get your law degree because then you can do many things. You don't have to practice law. You can do many, many, many different kinds of things, which has proven my experience throughout my life. I've seen people do all different kinds of corporate work, union work, organizing work, social services, everything. Writers, some of the best writing comes out of lawyers who learn how to cease writing like a lawyer.
Yeah, well, there are many of them who never learned that lesson, but yes, I can understand.
So how about your mom? Was she also, you said she was involved in...
She was a volunteer in a lot of causes, but she did not work for money except for a very brief period of time where she made gourmet desserts and sold them in a local gourmet shop. It turned out not to be worth the amount of time and effort it took. She didn't get much money out of it. So she and a number of her friends got together in something called Fullerton Farms, which was a tongue-in-cheek name, since Fullerton is not very farm-like in Chicago. But yeah, she did a lot of, she was the head of the Women's Board of the University of Chicago. She was a pretty dedicated volunteer on a number of things.
So Middlebury College, what led you to there, and then where did you go from there?
I was interested in going to a small liberal arts school. I got accepted to a number of places, and the only one I hadn't been to was Middlebury, so I saw it last. And it could be that the last impression was the strongest. And so I went there and majored in political science. Favorite course was, in fact, constitutional law, which was taught by a fellow who favored the sort of professor, what was the name of the paper chase, Kingsfield? You know, so, you know, Marbury versus Madison tells us what, Mr. You know, there was a lot of that, which scared the hell out of me, but I enjoyed the course a lot. And then I got into the college radio station, WRMC. Radio Middlebury College.
I'll be darned.
And I first started out playing records, and then I started doing a little bit of journalism light, at least, and I announced football games and hockey games and things like that.
You were a play-by-play?
I was a play-by-play.
Right.
I think most of the evidence of that has mercifully gone away. But although I just discovered in an attic in my trunk, there's an audio tape that I haven't listened to yet. It might have a little of that that infamy on it.
One of my guests was on a couple of shows, Bob Nagel, from who's the voice of Notre Dame women's basketball, and but many other sports as well, local high school and college and whatnot. And he was describing how he got into it and why he liked it. And then I said, well, what's it like in getting ready for a game? And then he broke into this patter. Well, here we are tonight. It's going to be a great game. And we have, and I thought, it's a complete change of character and voice.
Well, one of the most startling things that ever happened to me while I was eating. I was eating at a ballpark in Miami, and suddenly behind me I heard the voice of Vin Scully. And I thought, holy moly, I know who that is right away without turning around. And it was, of course, was Vin Scully, because the Marlins were playing the Dodgers. And I happened to be in the press box that night. But that's one of those moments where some light bulb goes on, just totally triggered by the auditory.
And for the five people in our audience who don't know who Vin Scully is.
The longtime play-by-play man, just retired of the Los Angeles Dodgers. And nationally, too. He broadcast all kinds of World Series.
Oh, yeah.
The Kurt Gibson call being the most famous thing he ever said, I think. But, yeah.
Well, all right. College led you into some broadcasting. Is that what you started with? That's what you wanted to do with your life?
Yeah, that's what I decided to pursue, and I got a job at WCAX-TV, Burlington, Vermont, and I was their Plattsburgh, New York reporter, meaning I had a film camera that weighed about as much as a battleship, and old heavy wooden tripod, and a separate audio amplifier. I had 40 pounds of equipment or something like that, and I would schlep it around, and when I wanted to do a stand-up in front of the camera, I would adjust my light, the light to my height. And then I would turn the camera on, run around in front, and replace the light in the picture and talk at the camera. So it was broadcasting 101, and it was a lot of fun.
You know, when I first started as a county prosecutor, one of the local reporters, television reporters, who was a grizzled veteran, and everybody considered very eccentric, and sometimes laughed at him because of his eccentricities. But he had to lug around these big cameras and all this equipment and whatnot. But he was very good. And in fact, he took a liking to me, or at least pitied me. And so after trying to do a show with me in which I was a complete flop, is giving him some sound bites, he said, turns off the camera. He says, John, would you like me to give you a little lesson on how to do this? And he led me through several sessions, short sessions, but teaching me how to do it. I was grateful.
Well, he did like you, because some people charge for that service and do media coaching, teach people how to be on camera and how to answer the questions or not answer the questions as they're as their predilection might be.
But he was carrying all that heavy load and he would come in. I remember he came into a meeting in the Bering County Board of Commissioners one time, and it was very dramatic. The board chairman was crying, making a pitch for his own honesty, and everybody's deathly quiet. And in comes Dennis. Clatter, bang, boom, 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 and he sees what's going on, and he turns up and he shouts to the after this man's been burying his soul and literally crying. He said, "Hey, could you do that again?
Oh,
I didn't get a picture."
well, I don't know. Maybe Dennis had talents, but asking somebody to start crying again is the broadcast news moment where you know the fake tear the reporter actually does there. But I started out covering Clinton County, New York government and going to those same meetings, and I probably made a lot of clanking noises when I came in as well.
Yeah.
But you know that's. It was a great way to learn how to do what I needed to do because I not only understood the reporting, but I got to shoot the video and tear the film and splice it and all that sort of thing.
So, it's great. Yep. It's great. We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Nick Bogert, who currently is a board member of the Museum of the Region of Three Oaks in Three Oaks, Michigan. But right now we're talking about his own background, which is phenomenal and interesting, and it's going to even be more so as we go on, as a reporter, as a TV personality around the country. Nick Bogert, and we'll be right back. This is John Smetanka on With Respect. We're now back on With Respect with Nick Bogert, who is a reporter, a cameraman, a chief cook and bottle washer for his career in the media around the country, but now is a director of a member of the board of directors of the Museum of the Region of Three Oaks. And we're going to be talking in a bit about some of the interesting and unusual things that they are doing with that museum. This is John Smetanka on With Respect. Now, Nick, when we broke, we were talking about how you got into journalism and how it was kind of a rough and ready kind of journalism that was going on these days, in those days. What about after that? Where did you go after Connecticut or Vermont?
I was a one-man bureau for a couple of years. Then I anchored the 11 o'clock news in Burlington, Vermont, and then I applied. I actually had two opportunities to move on. One was Grand Rapids, mm-hmm. and one was Miami.
Hmm.
And Grand Rapids couldn't quite offer me the job. they had to run it by. They had to do some more advertising for it, and the general manager just didn't want to pull the trigger. So I wound up in Miami,
uh-huh.
and I got there with my Vermont wardrobe in Miami in July, which is not recommended. But it was an amazing place because that summer. Rafts and boats full of Haitian immigrants were arriving on the shores, on the beaches. And within a year, there was a major race riot. Mm-hmm. And there was the Mariel boat lift.
What years were these?
So I got there in 79, in August of 79, just as Hurricane David was coming toward the coast. And I'm going, I have no idea what a hurricane.
Why did Mrs. Bogert allow me to go
there?
Yeah,
right. Yeah, who talked me into this? But then, you know, the next year there was the race riot and the Mariel boat lift was shortly thereafter, I think. So it was an amazing news town.
Wow.
And continued to be for several decades.
So how long did you stay there?
I was there for 30 years mm-hmm. in Miami, a couple of different stations and a couple of different roles. But I was there until 2009, so 79 to 2009.
So how did you top the Mariel boat lift and race riots and a hurricane coming all at one time. Did
I don't know. There was another year where we had Elian Gonzalez floating
right.
across the straits and living with his Miami relatives.
Yeah,
and
tell us about
combine
that,
that with the 2000 election. That was all in the same year. So Miami was a place where the news came pretty fast.
All right, let's talk about both those because they're interesting for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
The Mariel boat lift. The Elian Gonzalez case. Give me a short synopsis of that so we can understand it.
a boy is found on a raft or a floating device. I can't remember if it was a raft or an inner tube, with his mother who had died, and he is brought to Miami. The law calls for, called at that time at least, for any Cuban who got to this country and set foot on dry land to be offered asylum. And so the Miami Cubans, heavily anti-Castro Cubans, were adamant that the boy stay, whereas at that point, I think the Clinton administration wound up agreeing that the boy should go back to his father.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a protracted custody battle over this child, and the Miami relatives, became very famous, and there were media staking him out, and of course, your acquaintance Janet Reno decided mm-hmm. to order the federal marshals to go in and take the boy at one point, and the media by that point had been camped out in front of that house for weeks because it was clear that was going to happen at some point,
mm-hmm.
and. Yeah, and so he did eventually go back, and he became a poster boy for Castro's revolution,
mm-hmm.
And is called upon to come to state events and celebrated the fact that he came back.
And say how wonderful Castro's Cuba is.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen that. I've seen his,
sure.
his bits.
Well, it probably wasn't so bad for him because he's a cosseted, favored son, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's right.
The people who can't buy the groceries are not heroes of the revolution.
Right. So what was your role in that? I mean, what perspective did you have in watching this unfold?
Well, I mostly covered politics, so that when the fight over Elian got to Washington, I was up in Washington for several weeks in the spring of 2000. I remember being there the very first day he was staying with the Miami relatives, and I will say this is the single funniest thing anybody ever said to me on the scene of a story was a very clever reporter was standing next to me. Elian comes out, and he's dressed in a tracksuit, and he has a big gold chain around his neck. And the guy turns to me and says, "Oh, my God, they have him dressed like a draft choice." I just about fell on the floor, on the ground. So I was there and just doing, here's the boy and here are the relatives, and interviewing them and just sort of talking about the circumstances that had brought him there. That was very early, obviously, in all the legal maneuvering over whether he would go home. So I didn't cover it day by day. And when he was taken and the feds whisked him away to prepare him to go back to his father, who I think at that point was in Washington. Civil unrest broke out in Miami, in the mm-hmm. heavily Cuban areas of Miami. So I remember covering that a lot as well.
Now, you said you went up to Washington in that story and there
yeah.
for a couple of weeks or several weeks?
Yeah.
Day in and day out, you were covering it from D.C. because that was a story that was big in
the... I suspect it was a little bit of flying up and coming back on weekends, but I probably stayed for a weekend or two. It was that much a focus of the South Florida community.
See, that's the interesting thing that I'm always curious about in watching media stake out a story or take up a story. And I always wonder what it is that catches, because there's so many different kinds of things with this events around in the world's history and today especially, where there's constantly 24/7 news. What is it when you're a reporter that tells you this is that story? This is what you want to focus on?
Well, what people are talking about, what might be significant that people aren't talking about yet, that will have an effect down the road that people don't even anticipate. And you certainly get feedback from viewers about what they want to see. I mean, this one was a little bit of an open and shut case if you're in Miami media. The Cuban American community is the single most powerful ethnic bloc there. Miami's the only city in the country with a foreign policy. We would say that over and over, but it was true. I mean, they would pass resolutions condemning events in Cuba that the rest of the country pays no attention to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a you see this in a lot of cities where a certain issue seems completely gripping to a city or a region of the country, and the rest of the country couldn't care less about it. I think Elian Gonzalez was a huge story in Miami, only focused on marginally in other parts of the country. I mean, I remember that from when the race riots I talked about in 1980 broke out.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the country was watching Mount St. Helens explode. But in mm-hmm. Miami, of course, the explosion was the one on our front porch was the one that everybody was concerned with. So
You also mentioned the 2000 election as another in that year that, again, captures the national, but it, and was focused down in Florida.
Yeah.
And I remember watching parts of it, and I knew some of the attorneys who were involved and who were arguing for the for one side or the other. And it was that was like a honey hive for bears. They just couldn't. Mm-hmm. They the big ones came in and to handle
oh, yeah.
this.
Oh yeah.
And obviously, it had national. There's no question. It was national significance. You're talking about the presidential election. You're talking about silly things like the hanging chads and
well,
people running
I,
around.
I will tell you that the night of the election, I went home when it was declared, and I was called back within about 3 hours to get back on the on the set and start talking. I happen to know the word chad because there had been a case earlier, 10 years earlier maybe, where a local candidate had been allowed to hand inspect the ballots, and suddenly when he came out of that room, he was unsupervised. Suddenly there were more votes for him and more double punches for his opponent, which invalidated the tally. So I'd been to a court hearing about chads before, and I was pretty familiar with the technology that had obviously gone awry in the 2000
well, again,
election.
There are people who do not remember the 2000 election and the controversy of Bush versus Gore when it went to the U.S. Supreme Court. But one of the images, and again, I'm afraid that the younger people don't remember what a chad was. But I'm going to tell you, but before I ask you to describe it, one of my clients many years ago was the manufacturer
oh, really?
Of those ballots,
the punch cards,
cards, and the means to punch them to make the holes. And so, as a result of my representation, he gave me one of these ballot things, mm-hmm. and he used it as a parlor game for his friends. Here, see if you can make a hanging chad.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a game.
Yeah.
But tell me about this.
Well, so these are ballot punch cards. You slide them into a slot at the top of the ballot machine, and then you open up the ballot book, and it will show you which place to punch if you want to vote for A or B. And you have a little, they call it a stylus, actually, the little pin mm-hmm. that goes through the chads. And part of the problem was that the machines had been so badly maintained that there were lots of chads down the bottom, so that when people would poke, there was something resisting from below, so the chad didn't necessarily pop through. There were other problems. I mean, Palm Beach had a very confusing butterfly ballot, they called it, where people weren't sure where to poke for which candidate, and candidates that were not in the running wound up getting a lot more votes than they did anywhere else. So there was no paper trail beyond these cards. So these computer cards with their semi-punched holes became the canvassing boards would meet, and they'd all study the ballot very carefully and squint into the light to see whether there was a sign of voter intent, whether somebody had really meant to punch that chad, or whether it was by accident and had been damaged somehow. And that went on for weeks. And of course, the between Dade County, Miami, Broward County, Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach County, those were the three biggest counties population-wise. And then, you know, a lot of the action was in Tallahassee, so I wound up mm-hmm. there for 4 or 5 weeks.
I remember, as again, to set the picture, the parties thought that the election was over in Florida. I think even there may have been concession speeches or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then things began to change, and they started either going to have a recount in some counties or the whole state, and it got some of my acquaintances just rolled down there as fast as they could, and it became a legal question in several counties, and then it got to the Florida Court of Appeals, and then the Florida Supreme Court, which set the stage for televised hearings all around the country, maybe the world, of the justices in Tallahassee, asking questions and generally showing bias, I thought, mm-hmm. one way or the other. It was just a fascinating experience.
Didn't you think it was a good thing that it was available to be seen?
Oh, absolutely.
I'm a big advocate of cameras in the courtrooms.
Absolutely.
And they don't exist everywhere, but Florida had among the most liberal rules for mm-hmm. televising, and even the Supreme Court arguments were open.
I think that whichever side you took, it would have been very instructive and humbling to to watch this process go for the courts, through the media. It's a humbling process when you think about, you learn in school about civics and how everything is supposed to work very well and how the law is very dignified and everything, and then you get into one of these things in which it all goes out the window. And to this day, those people who were around when Bush Gore versus Gore came out and they ruled that the Florida Supreme Court had not followed the Constitution or whatever it was in their decision, and eventually Bush was declared the winner.
Right.
Now,
537 votes. That's what it boiled down to.
Out of the whole?
Out of 12 million,
I think it was 12 million votes.
Yeah.
And that changed the course of history.
Sure did. Yeah.
We're going to take a break again right now, but when we come back, we're going to talk about maybe a little bit more about stories you've worked that are interesting to you. But I want to talk about the Museum of the Region of Three Oaks and your role there and, you know, what kind of things you're doing. This is John Smetanka, Ryan With Respect, and we're talking to Nick Bogert, who is a member of the board of the Museum of the Region of Three Oaks. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Nick Bogert, who is a person of a fascinating background in media for decades around the country, but especially in the Miami and now we learn the Washington area and the Chicago area. We're going to be talking to him about in a bit, but is now a member of the board of the region, the Museum of the Region of Three Oaks, and we do want to talk about that as well. This is John Smetanka. So, Nick, when we broke, we talk about these fascinating cases that you worked, and I've got to say, ask the question: did you your family was interested in politics? You were interested in politics. You spent a lot of years covering politics and the intersection with life and law and whatnot. And we're going to talk just a bit again about Chicago. Gives you a different, another kind of, did you come out of all this with a particularly positive or negative or more educated view about how all this fits together?
Well, I hope it's a little more educated. I spent a lot of time sitting in courtrooms or in commission chambers. I mean, I have to say I have, you hear an awful lot about how terrible the political class is. And many of them are. I mean, I've certainly covered people I thought were pretty reprehensible. But I, generally speaking, have respect for people who put themselves out there and undertake those jobs. Because mm-hmm. I don't think whatever juice there is from being a county commissioner is worth the grief you get. That's mm-hmm. my own personal calculus.
Mm-hmm.
So I have some admiration for people who are in it for the right reasons. I have mm-hmm. contempt for those who pretty clearly aren't. And I knew a number of those in Miami. It's not, I don't know, Miami and Chicago have a pretty close race for corrupt politicians. I mean, there were some terrible folks who got in, and I watched them go down and get taken away in handcuffs in many, many instances.
Well, one of the famous ones that you may have had contact with was the last of the governors of the state of Illinois that went to prison? Mm-hmm. There were several. We can't keep track of them. Blagojevich,
yes.
Rod Blagojevich, was certainly one of the more dramatic cases. Did you have coverage of that?
I did. I covered that for MSNBC as a reporter. Mm-hmm. His retrial. I was not there for the first trial, but I had moved to Chicago by, I think that was 2010 or 11,
mm-hmm.
and I covered that. And yeah, it was very interesting. And those tapes painted a very damning picture. I mean, mm-hmm. certainly when you talk about people who are not in it for the right reasons, he would come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not what he did was illegal, even it was contemptuous. It was terrible, mm-hmm. It was the naked sort of horse trading. His defense was, this is just political horse trading, politics as usual. But to me, that was the lowest common denominator, the worst possible politics as usual that you could argue for. That was, you know, legally a good idea. It didn't work, but that was his defense, was, hey, I was just trading horses.
There was a famous cardinal in France in history that is either Mazarin or Richelieu that was quoted as commenting on the behavior of somebody else in the politics around him. And they were asking, well, is he guilty of a crime? And Mazarin is alleged to have said, it's worse than a crime. It's a blunder.
Well, yeah, this turned out to be both a crime and a blunder, this defense.
That's right.
Yeah, and Rod Blagojevich was just as you would imagine. He was always friendly. He loved to come up and schmooze people. I mean, mm-hmm. He had a limitless reservoir of bonhomie. Mm-hmm. And that's the part of politics I think he really enjoyed. I don't think he cared much for the policy or the governing, but he loved to glad hand and you know, have people call him governor.
Before we move on, the one thing about politicians, the good ones, I say probably the ones who are most successful, is that they love the campaigning part because they get strength. Like Bill Clinton, I saw Bill Clinton give a speech at Michigan State University to a big crowd, and I watched him literally before he got out of the limousine, and I was right next to him on the side of the car, and looked at him, and he had the sourest expression you've ever seen on a human being, miserable expression. The door
and
opened,
and then the switch went on.
And it was, he lit up and people were, you know, hugging and kissing, and it was amazing. And he kept that right up for the next 2 hours.
Well, I think our current president, no matter how you feel about his policies, it's pretty clear to me that he likes the campaigning part more than he likes the nitty-gritty details of the policy.
It is a fascinating combination for him of having to pick up governance. In politics, which he didn't have any experience.
Although Bill Clinton was sort of famously wonkish about the details of the policy, too.
Right,
so
besides that.
Yeah.
All right, now, you somehow got yourself over to Three Oaks and now involved in this fascinating thing called the Museum of the Region of Three Oaks. What's this all about?
Well, Three Oaks had a museum starting in 1916 when the town father, Edward K. Warren, E. K. Warren, established a museum that was it ran until the 50s, I think, sometime, and then it folded, and the collection was taken to Michigan State University, where it currently resides. And in 2006, the idea came about, and my uncle Harold Russell is the person who got me involved in it. He and a number of other people started this museum up again, and we're trying to bring it back into the center of life in the community. And it's a very interesting history. I think there are an awful lot of interesting episodes in this area, and we're trying to come up with ways to describe them either through video or museum exhibits or events. So that's
now,
where we are.
In this, you say that these exhibits went from Three Oaks when Warren died to Lansing. Are you bringing them back? Is that what you're saying?
My understanding, and I'm only on the board about 6 months now, so okay. I'm not totally familiar with the ins and outs of this. My understanding is that we certainly have the right to go and ask for things back on loan. Mm-hmm. The museum will never again take possession of them, but we can, and in fact have, gone to Michigan State and said we'd like to take item X and item Y and item Z back for a display. And generally speaking, my understanding is that Michigan State's been forthcoming in that regard. So we're hoping to do that a little bit with some of the E.K. Warren items that are there. I think that's an awful lot of their collection is what he donated.
So what is the range of things that you're going to be highlighting in this museum?
Well, we're going to have about three or four new exhibits this year. And one would be how local roads got their names, which will have several parts. Red Arrow Highway. Mm. The Red Arrow Division was a division of Wisconsin and Michigan National Guardsmen that was called in to fight in World War I. It was actually the first division to be on German soil, although it was a very quiet place where there wasn't a lot of action. But they wound up fighting in three or four of the most bloody battles of World War I, and they were the ones who breached the Hindenburg Line, which was thought to be unbreachable. It had been so dug in and so fortified that the thought was they couldn't possibly breach it. But if you look at the red arrow symbol on the highway, it's a red arrow going through a horizontal line, and that's mm-hmm. the Hindenburg line. That's meant to represent that.
I was always wondering about that.
Yeah, yeah. So they became the Red Arrow Division, and a French general dubbed them Les Terribles, the Terrible Ones, mm-hmm. because of their ferocity in fighting. Then they also fought in World War II in the Philippines and New Guinea and some places in the Pacific. And so it wasn't until 1953 that the highway was actually named for them. So that's mm-hmm. one. Flynn Road. In Three Oaks is a great story. Mr. Flynn was a manager of a Teamsters Excavators Union in Chicago in the 1920s. The Tribune has articles where his home was bombed, his brother was kidnapped, and the $10,000 ransom was demanded from him. He was arrested for shooting a man in a drugstore. He was implicated, although never charged, as far as I can tell, in a paving scandal. So he bought himself a home up here, and he built... a big building in downtown Sawyer, a movie theater, the Flynn Theater was there. Yeah. And as far as I can tell, his nose was very clean after that in Michigan. Mm-hmm. But he had a very interesting, colorful past, and he has a big, solid home. I'm told that the porch, the rail around the porch has glass on the top of it, just in case anybody was tempted to try and climb up onto his porch. There were several highly secure elements of the architecture. So he's a good story, and I've only recently gotten in contact with his daughter, who mm-hmm. lives in Michigan City now. And Whitaker Street, the main street mm-hmm. of New Buffalo. Mm-hmm. I'd never known who Whitaker was. Do you know?
No.
Captain Wessel Whitaker was a Great Lakes boat captain out of Buffalo. In November of 1834, his schooner, the Postboy, runs aground in Grand Beach. He walks to Michigan City for the night. Then the next day, he hires a wagon to take him up to St. Joe to report the loss. And he comes across the mouth of the Galeen River, and he says, "This is the Great Lakes port I've been looking for. I'm going to buy all the land around here." So he and his business partners bought it and then went bankrupt within 7 years. He tried to give away home lots to all the Great Lakes captains, hoping they'd berth their ships there. Mm-hmm. And they all said, "Thanks so much for the land," and then they turned around and sold it to someone else. So he died basically penniless, and it wasn't until the railroad came into Buffalo that the town mm-hmm. took off. So those are some of the stories. And we have another exhibit about the epidemic of Spanish flu 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we're going to try and beef up the E.K. Warren exhibit because 100 years ago this month, he died. And we will be marking that occasion on Elm Street in Three Oaks at noon on January 16th, which mm-hmm. is the day that he died. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a little ceremony kind of going over what he did for the town, which is...
It's a remarkable story.
Yeah.
That every so often I get bits and pieces of people who come on this show who tell different aspects of the Warrens and the Warren family and their contributions to this community. Remarkable. Absolutely yeah. stunning, remarkable.
I mean, there's no town that can be reduced to one person, but it's pretty close with Three Oaks that, mm-hmm. that E.K. Warren shaped the way the village and town and the whole area, you know, are to this day. I mean, mm-hmm. the industry that he brought to Three Oaks in inventing feather bone, and then, you know, his commitment to preserving natural places, you know, Warren Woods and Warren Dunes State mm-hmm. Parks mm-hmm. are only there because he gave land to the public. Mm-hmm. Really a remarkable fellow in a number of ways, and the Dewey Cannon, he brought that here.
What's the Dewey Cannon?
The Dewey Cannon is a cannon captured in the Battle of Manila by Admiral George Dewey.
In the Spanish-American War.
In the Spanish-American War in 1898, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And there was a contest held nationwide. The war bonds people said, whoever contributes the most to the war effort per capita will get the Dewey Cannon. And E.K. Warren mounted a campaign called Three Oaks Against the World. Had a big arch over Elm Street. There are pictures of this. And they raised, I think it was $1.41 for every man, woman, and child in town. And that turned out to be the highest per capita donation. And they won the cannon. And so in 1899, President McKinley was passing through town. And somehow E.K. Warren and other town fathers got a hold of him and said, "Would you stop and say a few words because we won this contest?" So President McKinley spoke. And then 6 months later, they dedicated the cannon, and thousands of people showed. I think 10,000 people came to Three Oaks to see wow. this dedication of the cannon, which, of course, still stands in Dewey Cannon Park, just east of of Elm Street.
You know, it's interesting because my second show, when I first started this program 13 years ago, was the Berrien County Historian. And I said, so our show, literally, was he walked us around the village of Three Oaks in a story, telling stories about what happened in Three Oaks, but also what happened in Galeen.
Is this Bob Myers?
Bob Myers.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah, he's phenomenal.
He was very helpful to me, too. Yeah,
he told me a story about how the Fort Dearborn Massacre in 1814 in Chicago, which is called something else, the Battle of Fort Dearborn by the Potawatomi tribe, because I also have their historian talking about the same incident. But the funny thing was with Bob was I said, well, is there any connection to the Fort Dearborn Massacre? And he said, well, yes, there is. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, it seems that after the battle, the people who were left fled from Illinois through Indiana, and many of them came to New Buffalo, and they settled, and some of them went farther north, but they fled to western Michigan. And I said, so that's the origin of the term FIP, F-I-P. And he said, I said, what do you mean? And I said, fleeing Illinois people.
Now, I've heard versions of that are less sanitized for radio.
I know. Yeah. But we came up with that for the first. We are the origin of that, this show.
Here's a great one. Show. Okay. Well, here's a great one I know from Florida, the halfbacks.
Okay.
Are what they call people who moved to Florida, and then when Florida got too crowded, they moved halfway back to New York, and they're now in North Carolina. So, yeah, everybody has
snowflakes.
Yeah, well, the people in Seattle talk about the people from California in this way as well. Yeah, sort of slightly derogatory, these.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway.
We're going to take another break. We're talking to Nick Bogert, who is a famous. He's even be more famous now as a correspondent and news person for many years around the country. But right now, he is a member of the board of the Museum of the Region of Three Oaks. And we're talking about the things that they're going to be highlighting and are highlighting at this museum here in Three Oaks. This is John Smetanka, run with respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Nick Bogert, who is a member of the board of the Museum of the Region of Three Oaks. And we've been talking to him about his history, but also, you know, what is this museum thing and why is this area, why does it need a museum? What's so famous about this area? He's been telling us. Now, this is John Smetanka. So now, Nick, this museum has been going on in its current organizational status. How long?
2006, it was revived.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, there were exhibits in the second floor of the library in Three Oaks.
Mm-hmm.
Then a building was built for the museum itself. It wasn't quite the building that the board had envisioned because the contractor took a lot of money and then didn't seem to have any left when it was time to build.
Oops.
So the building that's built was not really what they had in mind. So it has some limitations, but we're mm-hmm. working on that.
Mm-hmm. So now you mentioned the library in Three Oaks, which I find it, in and of itself worthy of a couple of hours of walking around. It is, as libraries go, you know, I've seen all these modern flashy, you know, in Mies van der Rohe sort of places, but this place is fascinating. And it was a part of the Warren operation.
It was E.K. Warren's office building, right.
And but it's now turned into a library.
Yes. Well, it was his office building for a long time, and then it was a bank for a long time, and now it is the public library, and it's a very beautiful building. It was said at the time to be one of the most modern and you know, one of the swell office buildings in the country. It was mm-hmm. it was It was noted as such in a book I read that he really was. He told his housekeeper that he made 50 cents every time the clock ticked, 50 cents a second, which in, 1900 terms is a lot of money. His estate was $7 million when he died, which is well over $100 million now in today's terms. So he was of the Gilded Age. He was one of those industrialists who had an idea, had a way to make it in a factory, which was somewhat new. And the problem, of course, for him was that his idea was how to make corset stays and buggy whips, neither of which were going to stand the test of time, given what happened to fashion and transportation. So it was however, I will say, even after those went out of style, the Warren Featherbone Company persisted in Three Oaks until the 50s and made a pretty good living doing sewing notions and then, rubber baby pants, and they were early into plastics. His great-grandson was talking, about 10 years ago about the E.K. Warren Company, and he said, we've cornered the market on two things that are completely obsolete. He said, the Dakota Indians have a saying, when your horse dies, dismount. So they dismounted, and they got into other things and were able to keep a lot of Three Oaks employed for many decades.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting story of, an industrialist who really hit it big, but then had to really adapt. And again, he died 100 years ago this month.
You know, the way you're talking about it, the way your face lights up about it, I can see the TV reporter thinking, how do I frame this shot? This is a great show. This is a great piece.
Well, I think he's a very interesting... I began making videos for the museum, just not as a board member, but just as an interested person 4 years ago. And my first video was the E.K. Warren story. It would seem for a region of Three Oaks Museum that you'd want to feature E.K. Warren first, because again, half the town that's standing there are buildings he built. And then I did another one on the Potawatomi, the Pekagan Band of Potawatomi, which I also find to be a very interesting story. And then Joe Savoldi, I don't know if you know that name, but an athlete. I did a film about him last summer.
And, tell us a little bit about him.
Joe Savoldi was born in Italy, and was a sickly, tiny little baby. His parents lived in Three Oaks. They ran a soda fountain. And Mrs. Savoldi's father gets stabbed by robbers. And she's called back to be with him and try and nurse him back to health. She races back to Italy. She's 8 months pregnant. She gets on a ship. She goes back there. She gives birth to this tiny preemie. And 6 hours later, his grandfather, her father, dies. He's so small, she can't take him back to Three Oaks. He wouldn't survive the voyage. So she comes back. She comes back to get him later, and he gets, I can't remember the childhood disease now, but he gets sick and can't go on an ocean voyage. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't come to Three Oaks until he's 12. And by then, he's a big, strapping guy, and he becomes the athlete in town. And he is the third baseman on the baseball team. He sets records for the shot put and the dash in track. And he's the center on a basketball team that goes to the Class C state finals. I mean, he's a real athlete, but his big sport is football. And he is impossible to tackle. I had someone tell me that his father always talked about the time he tried to tackle Joe Savoldi. He said, I went for his knees. The next thing I knew, I was on the sideline getting smelling salts. So Newt Rockne hears about him and brings him to Notre Dame. He doesn't play much for a couple of years. And then his junior year... he busts out in the third game or something like that, and he scores a whole bunch of touchdowns. And even though he didn't play for a good part of the season, he winds up as the second leading scorer and I think the leading rusher. And they win the national championship. They go undefeated. Next year, same thing. They go undefeated, win the national championship. He gains lots of yards in the sixth game or something like that, though he gets kicked out of school because he's secretly gotten married and he's seeking a divorce. Either of which will get you kicked out of Notre Dame.
Oh, yeah.
So he plays for the Bears for about 3 weeks. First, he's supposed to sign with the Green Bay Packers. And the Bears object and say, you're violating the rule that says the person's class has to graduate before you can sign them a professional contract. So the Packers back off, and then George Halas signs him and pays the fine. So he plays three games, and then he plays in an all-star team in Los Angeles, Notre Dame against the West Coast All-Stars, scores a bunch of touchdowns, and wrestling promoters approach him and say, we can make you more money in one match than you're going to make a whole year playing for George Halas. And he says, okay, I'm a wrestler. And he's a matinee idol, good-looking guy.
Yeah.
So he becomes a professional wrestler. After 3 years, he gets a shot at the world championship in Chicago. A guy named Landos, Jim Landos, is the world champion. Gives Savoldi a shot, and in the middle of the fight, there's sort of a mystery pin. The referee calls the fight for Savoldi, declares him the champion, and nobody can really see how he could have called it. And it turns out to have been a fix, complete fix. Two wrestling promoters trying to get back at each other, and Savoldi gets crowned champ. He holds the crown for 6 months and then gets beaten again. But then he wrestles throughout this country and then overseas. He goes to Asia and wrestles in, well, he goes to Australia and New Zealand and wrestles for a while, going back and forth between those two locations. And then he goes and lives in France and wrestles in Italy, where Mussolini considers him to be a favorite son. Oh. And he loves, he had invited Joe Savoldi to bring American football teams over earlier. Mm-hmm. So he was well aware that Joe Savoldi was kind of a big American star. And then World War II breaks out, and Joe Savoldi, having wrestled in Italy and apparently been denied purses by Mussolini, who wanted to keep him in Italy, he becomes a spy for the OSS, signs up to be a bodyguard for a New York businessman whose brother is one of the high admirals in the Italian command. So the plan is that Savoldi and the brother will sneak into Italy and try and arrange a meeting with the admiral, and he'll try and convince him to turn over the Italian Navy assets to the Allies.
Yeah, yeah.
And they land at Sicily first, and then they land at Salerno. The Brits get to the Italian Navy before they do, so eventually the Italian Navy does pretty much wind up helping the Allies more than the Germans. But then Savoldi stays. He trains MPs. He does a number of other missions for the OSS, and then comes back and lives in Harbert, and he puts on wrestling shows in Bridgman and in St. Joe and the Armory in Benton Harbor, I think it is. Lots of local, Silver Beach and St. Joe, wrestling. He winds up going back to college in the 50s when he's 45 years old.
Wait a minute. All this has happened before he's 45?
Yeah. Well, let's see. He's born in 1908, so maybe it's a little more. 48, 49.
All right. That's enough.
But he goes back to school, finally. His wife is from Kentucky, and they go down. He goes to the University of Evansville, and then he becomes a science teacher in Kentucky and dies after 7 or 8 years of doing that. But just a wild character. I mean, really a big character.
This is one of the fascinating things about having done this show over the years. I find so many stories about unique individuals in this area. Remarkable. Supreme Court justices, authors, politicians, Joe Savoldi. All of this out of this little region that no one, if you're driving through from Chicago to go to Detroit, have any appreciation for. And in fact, we hear don't have an appreciation of what we have.
Well, I've been living here part-time since I was 1 year old, and I'd never heard the name Joe Savoldi until a couple of years ago. Gary Lang, a local historian and sports aficionado, told me about him and then put on a little exhibit at the library. And once I read that story, I said, this has got to be... I did about a 25-minute video on him. There's lots of video of him playing for Notre Dame and him wrestling and that sort of thing. So it was fun to put together.
Are these going to be available at a museum?
These are currently available at the Museum of Three Oaks for $10.
These
videos.
Tell us quickly where
it's at. It's called 5 Featherbone Avenue, and that's the street just west of Elm Street, and it's kind of behind the library. We're going to put up some new signage this year to help people get to the museum, because it's not so hard to find unless
you know
where you're
going. And this event that's coming up is on January 16th, did you say?
January 16th, 100th anniversary of E.K. Warren's death, and it'll be right on Elm Street. There's a small concrete building that was where they handed out the paychecks from the Featherbone factory, and it's still owned, I believe, by a descendant of the Warrens. And there's a bust right next to that of E.K. Warren. We're going to hold the ceremony there, lay a wreath there, and we're going to have some local dignitaries and library folks, and we're going to give a little of that history. Yeah,
good.
It should be fun.
Now, you have a website, I hope. Do you?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
And what is your website?
Regionofthreeoaksmuseum.com. The website is currently being rehabbed, so in a couple of months it will be different.
Good.
I think it'll be upgraded, I hope. I'm working on that.
Nick Bogert, thank you very much for joining us on With Respect, learning about yourself, but also about the fascinating people in and around, in events in and around the region of Three Oaks.
Thank you, John.
The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday and Saturday and Thursday and all the ships at sea. But remember our motto, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.